This is a podcast from the Property and Environment Research Center in Bozeman, Montana. PERC is dedicated to improving environmental quality through property rights and markets. Learn more about our work at perc.org. Today we present a discussion from PERC's Wildfire Solutions Summit on July 22, 2016. Our speakers are Dean Luke and Jonathan Yoder, authors of the new PERC report, Clearing the Smoke from Wildfire Policy, where they examine various aspects of wildfires and responses from governments and landowners. The report is available at perc.org.
This is the report that John and I would love to have you look at, and PERC would, I'm sure, too, and feel free to contact us and or PERC if you have questions or you want further discussion and so forth. We're going to talk about the report in detail. I'll give you a sense of what's in it, and then we're going to talk about some things that are highlights and things we want you to think about as well to provoke some interesting discussion. So the report's laid out like this. We kind of look at some of the data issues. We conceptually lay out the idea of firefighting as an economic problem, so it's a bit of an abstract sort of a section, and we discuss how can you actually assess the data available, whether we're doing better or worse. I think that's a really difficult problem. John will talk most about that. We talk a bit about why you have this suppression organization, this network of fire crews and so forth that we have, and how it works. And we talk a bit at the end about some very specific policy reforms. There have been for the last year or so, four or five, I think, bills floating around the House and Congress in D.C. That are involved in this. And there's a little bit of discussion of that as well. So that's what the report does. What I'm going to do today, I'm going to talk about the economic institutions of wildfire management, and John will talk about the data and these reforms. So that's kind of what we'll do in the next bit of time. One thing I think you, when you study fire for a while, and Dave got at this as well, the variation in fire is tremendous over time and space. This has been a relatively mild fire year in the U.S. It was a huge fire year in Alberta. There's just one fire, the Fort McMurray fire, which was over 1 million acres and evacuated 80,000 people and so forth. That fire would have been, and put this in a little perspective, that fire would have been a non-issue 100 years ago because there was no one there. There are big fires in northern Canada and Alaska all the time, and John will show you some data. And sometimes the acreage burn in the U.S. is half of that is fires in Alaska, okay? Which are mostly suppressed at a relatively low level. And so you have this big fire in Fort McMurray. It seems like, oh, we're off to a crazy fire year, but it was really not the case. And it's been quiet in lots of places, and it can be hot in Arizona, a hot fire year in Arizona 1 year, and a big fire year in Idaho, the same year. So we lay out some questions we want to look at. Are we really getting these larger and more frequent fires? How can we evaluate the efficiency of management and policies? How do these organizations work and how do the incentives play out? And do these policy proposals, are they likely to improve the effectiveness of wildfire management? I think the answer is already kind of out there. I would say no, and we'll get in more detail. They're not really going to change the fundamental incentives. They will give the agencies more money to do some other things. I don't see them as changing the incentives of landowners, particularly, or suppression organizations. So, thinking about firefighting as an economic problem. So, this is a kind of a conceptual thing I want to talk about for a bit. The way to think about this, you first have to think about, well, what is fire? How do you think of it as an economic asset, so to speak? If we were going to talk about groundwater or an airshed or something, you'd say, well, here's an airshed, and we've got a lot of people using it. We have to have some joint management plan or contract maybe between users. If we have an underground mine, same sort of thing. How do we optimally use this? So that's our starting point in this analysis. And the way we think about it is we think of fire in terms of what we call a firescape or a fire shed, a collection of firescapes. There we go. So just imagine a piece of land here, a flat piece of land, And if you had a fire start here, that's what the fire would do, unchecked, if you will. And we're not going to worry about past management, which can influence that, of course. And the question is, well, you know, what do you want to do? Do you want to let it go to its full extent, or do you want to try to stop it? And what would the cost of stopping it be? A firescape would be a larger landscape with a bunch of these things. This is a conceptual idea. In some places, it can be fairly routine that this little area will burn about every 10 years. In some kinds of ecosystems like ponderosa pine, you can sort of get repeated burning of almost identical areas. Oftentimes, however, it's more of a vague boundary that you might think of in a statistical sense is, well, there's a fire shed out here somewhere. But you want to think of it conceptually to start as, well, how would you optimally manage that thing? Do you want to do something, nothing, or something in between? And fires typically grow something like this. So this is a little more detailed view. So here's our fire shed, and there's a start there. If it's on flat land, let's say homogeneous landscape, just all say ponderosa pine, it'll sort of go with the wind and sort of an ellipse, the fire scientists tell us more or less. And the growth rates will kind of tend to be maybe something like this, where there's a period of relatively slow growth and then a period of relatively fast growth of the fire, and then it finally ends, it gets to its maximum size, so to speak. The thing that you can immediately learn from this little picture, So in here, if you got right here with your suppression crew, you could put the fire out when it hadn't done much damage. If you wait, you know, a little longer, you get a lot of damage. In this part of the fire region, if you just wait a little longer, the amount of damage, potential damage because the fire has grown, can be very rapid. So this introduced the idea of timeliness and emergency conditions into firefighting, which is similar to medical emergencies as well. So a guy gets run over by a truck in the street. Yeah, it's a very simple procedure. We pull him out of the street, and a better example, you say you get a piece of steak in your throat. Would you just wait a second? I have to go to the bathroom. They'll be back, and I'll get the steak out. Okay, it's too late now. It's a simple procedure. The cost was low, but the timing is everything. So this will influence the optimal structure of suppression. Same with urban fires as well. You have fire trucks that are within, say, 5 minutes typically of every resident in an urban fire zone, so to speak. So that's important. Lest you think that's just sort of theory, this is, you know, a good example. This is the station fire progression. Big fire in California, 150,000 acres just north of LA. And there's the map that you could then link to the days. The fire grew very rapidly. I mean, look at this. It goes from 5,000 acres to over 100,000 acres in just a couple days, and then it sort of dies out. And the effectiveness of suppression, Dave has suggested, often when fires get going, you can't really do much. They sort of play themselves out. One of the things we talked about back in the day when I was fighting fires as well, hoping to get this fire out before the snow comes. That was sort of the joke. And a lot of the fires in the Northern Rockies are put out ultimately by the first snows in late August or early September. When they get big, oftentimes suppression doesn't have much impact. So fires do look like this. The landscape gets very complicated, however, and this is a big point that we want to stress, and it was implicit in a lot of things said already. So here's a simple world where there's our fire shed, and it's my land. I own all 10,000 acres, and that's the fire shed. I would take care of it just like I would take care of my pasture or my house. I have to be in the right place here. On the other hand, if you go to the slide to the right, if there's a bunch of us sitting over that firescape, we all have different incentives here. If the fire starts on your land, or for my land, it might burn off my land in a matter of a few hours, then it's everybody else's problem down the road. So unless we coordinate to manage that area, we can get some suboptimal result. If you Then add that some of those landowners may be a government agency and so forth, it gets more complicated. If you throw in the mix these blue things, which we're just calling valuable assets, say homes and so forth, the WUI, those things are more valuable, more than that is, in other words, they're worth protecting more than the orange stuff around it. So we've got a $500,000 house, then we've got some relatively inexpensive grassland around it. You now have a different sort of problem as well. It can get very complicated very fast. And so what that means from an economic perspective is that the optimal action can vary from essentially nothing to all-out suppression to maybe just protecting those blue dots and just letting the fire otherwise go on its own. So you think back to the Yellowstone fires in 88, basically the Park Service let the fire burn except around the buildings and the Old Faithful, etc., which I think in hindsight seems like a pretty nearly efficient kind of response, although it was met with a lot of hostility by the public at the time. So the economic forces then at play, once you understand the behavior of fire and the idea of a fire escape and fire growth and so forth, are the following. You have this idea of emergency conditions, which gives a reason to have people in proximity to potential fires, just like we have urban firefighting. And that means upfront assets deployed, ready to be deployed and trained, if you will. You have this complicated land ownership and asset distribution problem where you've got different incentives of different landowners that all have a stake, but a small stake in a large landscape problem, much like air pollution, underground water, and so forth. And of course, then you have a layer on top of this, the uncertainty. You don't know exactly where that fire shed is going to be. That makes it different than, and more complicated, and I think harder than groundwater or underground vein of coal, because the vein of coal, it's there. It's not here one day and there the next. The fire shed is, could be here, could be here, and it might not pop back up again, if you will, for 5 years, 10, and so forth. That creates a more complicated sort of optimal economic response, if you will. Okay. And so, as I mentioned, the optimal suppression can vary very widely across fire escapes. This is something important for people to understand. It could be zero, which is almost what it is in Alaska often. You have these big fires and, you know, although I have to say I did go on fires out in the middle of nowhere in Alaska where we, you know, watch fires burn, and you know, you wonder why we're there, and you know, why you're there is the incentive structure of the Forest Service and the BLM and so forth. But often, what's happening now, which I think is a good thing, is that you're protecting villages and so forth, and these fires become a million acres, and this spruce stuff, you know, basically at the around the Arctic Circle, it could be a very aggressive initial attack if you have a lot of values at stake, high values at stake, and so forth. It could be point protection only, that is just protect around Old Faithful and the buildings and so forth. It could be a mix of these things depending where you are. There is a real rationale, however, for this large network of specialized crews pre-positioned all over the place that can be moved as demand arises as fire seasons are different in different parts of the world. So you have people in Idaho who can go down to Arizona in June, and then Arizona people can go up to Idaho in July and August, and so on and so forth. And that's basically what we've had. We've evolved to have this large-scale network dominated by federal agencies, organized in sort of a military hierarchy, in which we have that kind of incentive structure in place. So there's a logic to that. At the same time, however, there's a lot of incentive problems built into that. And I think we have to recognize that as well, that we're unlikely, I think, to get something that is going to look efficient really to almost anybody. And then there's the matter of assessing the data to even make that kind of assessment. So what I've hopefully I've given you, we have a little table here. I'm going to point out a few things here. I don't know if you can see many of those. It's in detail in the paper. Things really change after the 1910 burn, which was largely on newly established national forest land here in Montana and Idaho, where around 3 million acres burned, the town of Wallace burned up, etc. And that really motivated a lot of changes in law and policy at the federal level. The Forest Service grew dramatically. It got in the next couple decades, got great acreage throughout the West. Fire became a priority. Acts in Congress were passed to establish funding basically in sort of what we sometimes call a blank check way for suppression. Over the next 20, 30 years, you start to develop these specialized crews. You get the big network really gets organized, I would say, when the Boise Interagency Fire Center is established in the 60s, which becomes NIFC, and then it later gets linked into the incident command system for all emergencies from, you know, earthquakes to tornadoes to hurricanes and so forth. Dave talked a little bit about the Flame Act of 2009, which created a separate budget line for suppression of large fires in particular. And then you have these bills pending now, which are mostly designed, John will talk more about them too, to sort of separate fuels management from suppression fundings for some of the agencies and so on. So that's what we have. And so what we have is this complex network dominated by federal agencies. And that makes some sense. In the West, we've got agencies being the dominant landowner. Now, this is not really how it works in the Southeast, as Dave mentioned. The land ownership is very different. You have, again, you have organizations and institutions that require burning, much like you'd have to require control of noxious weeds on private land here. So we could think about new institutions, especially in the WUI, and that's one thing I'll try to mention in maybe in the Q&A if we get to it. But the system is full of a ton of weak incentives. Okay, basically, firefighters and incident commanders face zero marginal costs of bringing more resources to the program. The resources are in place and they're available throughout the network. If I want to order more planes or more crews, it doesn't cost me a thing. I also don't own the land, so I don't know the value of what I'm being protected. So it's a very sort of bureaucratic, rule-driven decision-making that's also influenced by the incentives for compensation and career advancement by the firefighters. I will also say an incentive that's here now with the Forest Service in particular, the Forest Service really can't sell its timber in any meaningful way. So valuable timber, there's no such thing as valuable timber on the forest land. Forest Service land in general. And this can be a big problem, say in a place like Northern California, where you have very valuable commercial timberland adjacent to the Forest Service land, where the implicit value to Forest Service managers is zero because we're not allowed to cut timber from NEPA, ESA, and so forth. And so they have no incentive to protect timber like they would have if that was commercial timber that could generate revenue for the Forest Service and so forth. This, I think, could be a big thing. So you've got these kind of incentives as well. In some case, the management objectives for the Forest Service is to increase burning, that is to let natural fires go. So when you look back at these data, John will talk about them, we see fires getting bigger. It's not a purely natural phenomenon. The size of the fire depends on the land manage that took place before the fire and action on the fire. And sometimes there's real incentive to just let the fires go. And that may be good, but when the public see these data, we're getting more and bigger fires. Some of these bigger fires we're just letting burn, actually. And that's good, but it might look bad in the sense that, you know, the general concern is we're getting more fires, bigger fires, and so forth. And that is not necessarily a bad thing. This is the point where John Yoder comes in, so I'll slip out.
So what I'll do first is provide a little bit of background in terms of data, kind of big aggregate look at data. I don't even know how to do this with this clicker, so I'm actually going to have to get close here. Okay, so we had a question earlier about fires in the eastern U.S. versus fires in the western U.S., and I broke that already. And really the big difference has to do with the size of fires. I mean, if you look at the data here, we have about 50% of fires in terms of the number of fires happening in kind of the eastern two-thirds of the U.S., about 50% happening in the 17 western states. But the vast majority, you know, pushing 90% of the acres burned is in the 17 western states. So that's driven largely by some things that Dave Calkin talked about, differences in kind of the fire characteristics of the landscape in the west versus the east, with the southeast being particularly important in terms of fire and fire management in the eastern U.S. Here is a look at the 11 western states in terms of fire numbers and fire acreage across states. If you look on the left side of that graph, we have several different looks, perspectives on acres burned. Okay, so Alaska has by far, on average, the largest number of acres burned of any state. In terms of both total numbers of acres and in terms of percentage of acres burned as a percentage of acres burned in the U.S. Interestingly enough, though, Idaho is the leader when it comes to the number of acres per state acreage. Okay, so for a given state size, more of Idaho burns in any given year as a percentage of its total acreage than any other state. In terms of the numbers of fires, California dominates. Okay, lots of fires in California. Alaska, even though the acreage is huge, it's down there pretty far in terms of the numbers of fires, just because the fires tend to be much larger. And I invite you to think about why those differences exist, partly in terms of the ecosystems within which those fires occur, as well as the incentives in terms of suppression and land management and land characteristics across those different states. So now let's back up and take a more aggregate look over time in terms of the number of acres burned, number of fires, and kind of average fire size. You'll see again on the left, the number of acres burned there seems to be kind of a weak but really noisy trend, okay, upward. We see a little bit of a break, maybe. We can imagine a break, perhaps, somewhere around 2000, perhaps 2001. The number of fires, on the other hand, there's no obvious trend. Again, very noisy, lots of interannual variation, but it's not clear that there's a trend one way or another in terms of the number of fires in aggregate in the U.S. in general. The kind of the consequence of those two numbers leads to an estimate of the number of acres per fire, and you can see again there is a bit of a plateau here until about 2000 or so, and then we see a noisy potential increase in the size of fires. On the right-hand side, we have some plots of costs. Okay, costs of fire suppression expenditures. And these are in 2015 dollars. Also look like they're going up as well. Okay, and why don't you take a kind of keep your eye on right at about that 2000-2001 time period. There just seems to be a little bit of a jump there, and we'll come back to that later. The cost per fire also seems to be going up as of about 2001 or so, and the cost per acre on the lower right hand side there, much like the number of fires, the cost per acre of land burned doesn't seem to have any particular trend associated with it, although it's super noisy. And then here's an interesting set of data that shows the number of structures destroyed per year in the U.S., kind of averaged by decade. Okay, so this relates to the wildland-urban interface comments and questions that we've heard already. That's a pretty striking increase as well, relating to the essentially the values at risk due to wildfire and its relationship to the wildland-urban interface. Oops, I actually need to return here. We've been talking a little bit about efficiency, efficient wildfire suppression, efficient wildfire response, efficient wildfire management. How can we assess efficiency? Well, a very simplistic perspective, kind of a standard Econ 101 perspective on that question would be to think about applying suppression effort or management effort more generally to the point where the value of an additional dollar spent on that activity provides at least a dollar's worth of benefit in terms of damage reduction. Okay, so complex perspective on that particular, perhaps you can call it a kind of a trite prescription, is you can allocate scarce resources in a cost-effective way by making sure that the value of those resources at the margin are essentially distributed effectively across all kinds of activities to reduce damage from wildfires. And Dave Calkin was talking about leverage points, I think, in terms of finding those most productive activities before fires happen and during fire suppression efforts, such that the value of those suppression activities are used as effectively as possible. All right, so let's think about how we can actually assess suppression effectiveness. Let's start by first looking at the type of data that are kind of readily available, the kind of data that you can gather from the National Interagency Fire Center and other sources that are widely available. We have data on the number of fires per year, total acres burned, average fire sizes, suppression costs per fire, suppression costs per acre burned, and these can come from various different databases that are available that the Forest Service and other agencies keep track of. Dave Calkin, as far as I know, knows these data better than anyone else in the world, and so we talk to him quite regularly about these data when we're working on these fire problems. Notice, though, what's missing from this set of data. These really all relate to the cost side of suppression, okay, expenditures, and they don't really relate to the benefits of suppression. Okay, we don't have kind of systematically collected data that relate to damage from wildfires in such a way that allow us to connect suppression activity to damage reduction. Okay, certainly not even within the course of a year, but certainly not within the course of several years to understand how fire suppression and exclusion 10 years ago might affect wildfire outcomes and the costliness of suppression activities this year. Okay, so it's difficult to assess the economic value of suppression if we don't have information about damage and in order to assess kind of the foregone damage that results from suppression. And therefore, it's also difficult to assess suppression productivity and efficiency more specifically. So finally then, to kind of wrap things up, there has been some legislative activity and administrative activity to try and deal with these increases in wildfire suppression expenditures. Dave Calkin also mentioned that these issues to some extent earlier. In 2001, Over the last bunch of years, in fact, what has happened is that suppression budgets have been provided, and in most years recently, those suppression budgets have been used up, and the Forest Service and other agencies have had to borrow from other funds to pay for the suppression to kind of finish out the seasons. Okay, so there is this budgeting problem that has tended to happen, that this legislative activity has tried to address. Okay, and in 2001, after a pretty severe fire year, 2001 budgets, the budget allocations essentially doubled. Okay, and if we think back to the graphs that we looked at earlier, we saw jumps in suppression expenditures when the overall wildfire suppression budget or wildfire allocations increased. So the question really becomes then, what problems are these kinds of funding changes? Oh, here, actually, thank you very much. Here are some graphs of federal suppression expenditures and federal wildfire management appropriations with that vertical red line at the year 2001, when appropriations essentially doubled. And what we see is, particularly with respect to the Forest Service, not quite so much Department of Interior, but also some increases there, pretty big increases in suppression expenditures as a result, perhaps, of an increase in management appropriations. So what do these kinds of policy decisions do? Well, they provide more funding for suppression. That's perhaps good, but it's hard to assess because the extent to which we really don't have information on the reductions in damage that follow from increased suppression expenditures. What they don't tend to do is address the underlying incentive problems that Dean was talking about and that the other two speakers were talking about as well. And so the question is, what kind of policies might affect incentives to reduce suppression costs and manage suppression activities effectively in order to manage wildfires efficiently? Well, a couple of authors, Jeff Donovan, who I think Dave already mentioned, and Tom Brown, have proposed a policy fix that would essentially allow fire managers to bank their suppression funding that they don't use from one year to the next. Okay, so basically the proposal would provide fire managers an opportunity cost for using fire suppression budgets this year in the form of using up their capacity to use that budget for next year, right? The problem with this proposal, so this is a good idea in general. The problem for this, in terms of this proposal, is that it continues to rely on a fixed kind of long-term suppression budget that is credibly fixed and relies on this notion that politically speaking, we can maintain a suppression budget and limit a suppression budget so that people, that expenditures are basically capped in the long run. This is a politically very difficult thing to do. It is a problem that is recurring over and over. Another perspective on what we might do to think about how to manage this weak incentive for basically cost minimization due to the blank check policy or the effective blank check policy is to look at the economics of the interaction between pre-suppression and suppression activity. So pre-season planning and contracting. Understand how that affects wildfire suppression costs, basically the variable costs of wildfire suppression during the fire season, and invest in pre-season, pre-suppression activities, resource allocation across space, contracting, etc., in such a way that mitigates the sum total of pre-suppression and suppression investments by basically tweaking the marginal costs of suppression during the fire season. So thinking about how we can affect suppression cost outcomes by making pre-season investments in terms of resource allocation and planning. So at that, I'll leave it at that and summarize very quickly. So typical wildfire data are highly aggregated, often unmask real underlying changes and problem areas in suppression incentives. Economics, though, in terms of the stuff that Dean talked about, gives a framework for assessing wildfire management. The complexity of wildfire begets a complex organizational network that's filled with weak incentives. And current reform proposals that are really focused on budget fixes really don't do much to change the incentives of these organizations to really focus more on efficient wildfire suppression activities. And that's it. Thank you very much.
That was Dean Luke and Jonathan Yoder, authors of the new PERC report, Clearing the Smoke from Wildfire Policy, available at perc.org. You've been listening to the PERC podcast from the Property and Environment Research Center in Bozeman, Montana. PERC is dedicated to improving environmental quality through property rights and markets. Learn more about our work at perc.org.